Without further ado, I would like to introduce Mr. David Borstein, author of The Price of a Dream and How to Change the World.
Thank you, Bruce, Dean Basco. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, I graduated from McGill University in 1985, the year that Windows was launched. And, you know, the idea of social entrepreneurship was nowhere near, you know, nowhere on my radar screen. I was either going to become a millionaire by going into the computer field, which is what I did. I became a computer programmer, or become a doctor or lawyer. And I never even thought about anything remotely like this. And even as recently as, you know, five or six years ago, when I would speak about the Grameen Bank or about social entrepreneurship, it would be hard to get more than a dozen people in a room at a college, maybe 20 people, and nobody would show up to a bookstore. So there's really quite a change, and I think I salute you, Bruce, for entrepreneurship in the context of the academy, where it's really very much needed. My first career, as I mentioned, was as a computer programmer, and I found that I didn't quite feel as alive as I wanted to feel, just, you know, in my day-to-day goings and comings. So I switched to journalism and wrote for New York Newsday for a few years, and also felt a little dispirited by the kind of stories that I was covering over and over again. Just the negative, the problem frame that the media takes to the world. And I heard about the Grameen Bank, and so I just decided on a whim to go to Bangladesh in 1992. I had been reading about the Grameen Bank for 2 years. And I was quite surprised to hear about this organization that was, at that time, making loans to close to 1 million women across Bangladesh. How many people here know about the Grameen Bank, have heard about it? Okay, this is great. To me, when I was on the plane going to Bangladesh, it was, I basically thought that I was going to have a nice travel experience, or an interesting travel experience. I was hoping that I didn't get malaria or dysentery. And my mother was very worried, needless to say. But I didn't really, I think in my heart, expect that it was alleviating poverty in Bangladesh. I didn't expect that it would be working as I understand it now to be. I thought I'd get a couple of nice stories. But after spending 5 months in villages talking to villagers with a translator and hearing the same story over and over and over again, how a villager had received a small loan, typically less than $100 a year, and then paid it back at the rate of 2% per week for 50 weeks, the principal, and then interest at the end of the year, and how through the acquisition of a small asset, you know, a cow, some bamboo, a sewing machine, some sort of productive asset, they were able to pay off the loan, take ownership of that asset, and through this iterative process over time, really move themselves out of very oppressive poverty to what we would still consider poor, but is far less oppressive. What that literally translates to is initially from one meal a day or two meals a day to 3 meals a day for everyone in the family, from having certain periods of the year when there is genuine scarcity for months at a time to having enough food during those months that were between harvest time, to having a tin roof over the house to keep the family dry during the monsoon season, having a vegetable garden, crockery, and being able to send sons and daughters to school, to primary school. So these were enormous changes in the context of villagers' lives. And the idea, the fact that a small amount of money, $75 or $80 a year as credit, could make these changes possible, just sort of blew my mind. I thought, my goodness, how much capacity we have to change the world. So that was, you know, my first revelation was that microcredit really was powerful. But then when I stood back and I said, how did this organization, the Grameen Bank, which just means the village bank, get built? And why is it so much better than the development organizations in the rest of Bangladesh, most of which are pretty bad and some of which are just terrible? And why is it so much better than the performance that we typically see or frequently see from governments and international development organizations? And when I thought about it, and after interviewing Grameen Bank staff members, many, many villagers, many, many people in the international development community in Bangladesh and around the world, I saw that the Grameen Bank had grown by a completely different process than we normally think of programs that are socially focused. So for one thing, It wasn't a top-down process. Nobody planned the Grameen Bank. Muhammad Yunus, the founder, initially, there was a famine in 1974, and in response to the famine, he started going into the villages with his graduate students because he felt that his teaching was completely irrelevant, teaching economics in the context of a classroom while people literally were starving outside. It didn't make sense to him. So he got his graduate students out into the villages, and they just started trying different things out. You know, the first couple of experiments they tried didn't work at all. So this was not an immaculate conception. They did vaccinations, they did work with farms, they tried to do what they called a three-share farm, which failed. And it was only after about 4 years of experiments that Yunus stumbled upon the idea, quite serendipitously, of credit, because he happened to have a conversation with a very talented and capable beggar who was making half-time beggar and half-time bamboo stool maker, and while she was trying to support herself making these bamboo stools, she still had to go out and beg. And Yunus thought, this is crazy. Why can't you support yourself? Your stools are of very high quality. And she told him the story about the fact that she was essentially in bonded debt to the money lender and had to sell all her stools to him. So this situation made him see village life in a completely different way. And then this process got started that looked very different from the planning top-down process of development. So what an entrepreneur does, and all of you know this experience, and will be going through this experience if you haven't already started, is the first thing that they do is they have an idea, they sort of see over the horizon to a possibility that other people don't yet see, and perhaps don't believe in yet. Then they pull a bunch of people together. In Eunice's case, it was his graduate students, and then they have to go out and mobilize resources, essentially filling up, the cup. Well, before really you have anything to show for your work, and that's where the ability to help other people see the vision, even before the vision is real, comes from. And so this is what Yunus did. And then, of course, as any entrepreneur knows, as you have a business plan, and as soon as the ink is dry on the business plan, and you've tried to implement some of the things you promised to do, you have to change your business plan radically because you realize that five of your assumptions were wrong, that the market has changed, that in fact people don't behave this way, and you couldn't convince anyone to do X, Y, and Z. And so you have to change all of these variables. And so you rewrite your business plan, and in fact you're constantly reinventing your organization as it goes, seeing new opportunities and overcoming hurdles that you didn't anticipate. And through this continuous process of problem solving, after a number of years, you develop what can be thought of as an idea, an actual working real idea that's been tested and is able to grow. And it's interesting because if you think about it, the Grameen Bank today, which many of you probably know, lends money to more than 7 million villagers in Bangladesh, which represents, you know, close to 40% of the families in the country, and 97% of its borrowers are women, only started lending money primarily to women in its eighth year. Okay? So now think about it in political terms. That's the end of the second term of the president. They finally figured out the idea. They figured out something essential to the idea that is now the thing that they're most known for. Right? Think about the how long it takes to really get the innovation in an experimental, real-world context, and how our political processes make that very, very different. And that really explains, to me, that's one explanation of why social entrepreneurship is so valuable and why social innovators today around the world are able to produce solutions to social problems that have eluded public systems, because the experimental process is much more amenable to the entrepreneurial approach than it is to the planning and having to show results within the shutter speed of the election cycle approach. So I pulled back after writing when I finished The Price of a Dream. I thought, what's the real conclusion here about? Is it that microcredit's great and everybody should get a loan? Or is it that there's really a process here by which excellence is created and targeted at the solution of major social problems? And that was, the conclusion of the book was, let's try to apply more of this entrepreneurial approach that Yunus took. And entrepreneurial, not in the sense that they're lending money, but in the sense that they built it from the bottom up in the same way that most businesses, most great businesses, all great businesses are born. So my conclusion was, let's look for more social entrepreneurs around the world and see if we can create structural supports to let them grow, the way we do that for business entrepreneurs. And I had at that time, I didn't think there were any around. And a friend of mine said to me, well, you should go and speak to Bill Drayton, because that's what he's been doing with Ashoka for the past 15 years. This was in 1997. Now, how many people have heard of Ashoka? It's much less known. Okay. So recently, Bill Clinton, who in 1992 said, I hope Muhammad Yunus will one day win the Nobel Peace Prize when he was running for president, recently said, I hope I'll live long enough to see Bill Drayton win the Nobel Peace Prize for the idea of social entrepreneurship and really advancing it in the world. That's how important Clinton thought it was. What Bill had done is he had created a system to go around the world looking for, in a sort of a venture capital model, looking for promising entrepreneurs who are creating organizations, but the goal of those organizations was to solve a fundamental and major social problem, a system problem. And he created a nominator network and started spreading this, initially in India and then Indonesia, and then they went to Brazil, and now they're working in about 70 countries. And what I had the pleasure of doing after I met Bill, I interviewed him, and I thought, wow, this man is very smart, and his idea makes a lot of sense to me. And so I just decided to travel to different countries and interview some of the social entrepreneurs that Ashoka had identified through its network. They call them Ashoka Fellows. And then, of course, through this process of 5 years of research, I met a lot of other people along the way, and I interviewed more than 100 social entrepreneurs. And I have to say, you know, looking at everybody in this room, I see the world completely differently than I did when I started this process. And I don't think I could have gained the particular view or feeling I have about the world if I had read the newspapers every day around the world for 50 years. I don't think I could have seen, because we don't have a lens into this world. We you know, 95% of the information we get really talks about, you know, how many problems we have and what's going wrong in our society. And if we liken the media that we have to parents, it would be very bad parenting, because in a sense we would be criticizing our children all the time in hopes that they will grow up to be healthy children. And we know that intuitively that you don't do that. You have to discover the strengths in somebody and help those strengths grow and emerge. And really that's what Ashoka has been trying to do with social entrepreneurship. So I'll give you a few examples of some people that I met along the way, and just to give you a sense of what's going on out there in the world that we don't often hear about. When I was in Bombay, India, I met a social worker named Jeru Bilimoria, who she had actually gone to school in New York City at the New School, and while she was in New York, she worked for the Coalition for the Homeless and became very focused on helping homeless people through the outreach efforts in the city. When she went back to Bombay, she decided that she wanted to continue doing that work, and the most likely candidates were the street kids all across Bombay. India has millions of children living on the streets today because of all sorts of economic pressures in villages, and they're generally unprotected. So you might have 8 or 9 year old kids selling cigarettes and Wrigley spearmint gum in the boulevards of Bombay with traffic going around all around them as a way to make money so that they could send remittances back to their families. And they might sleep in a tea stall or on the railway platform at night, or in a shelter if they're lucky. And they're pretty much on their own. And kids get beaten up all the time. And so Jeru started hanging out with the street kids. She started with her graduate students, like Muhammad Yunus. She did it as a teacher. She went into the night shelters, and she started getting to know the students, and they did research studies as part of their classwork. And she found, also giving out her home phone number to the kids, that the kids often called her up at 3 a.m. because, you know, someone had broken a leg, or my friend has tuberculosis and the hospital won't admit him, or so, you know, all these kinds of problems. And so Jeru, at that time, she had a real need. And all social entrepreneurship begins with a felt need. It's not an abstract, you know, concept. You don't say, I'm going to do this because I want to become famous or I'm going to get rich. It's because you can't stand the thing that's in front of you that you see happening, and you know that it doesn't have to be that way. And in her case, she had worked a lot in Bombay with various social services, and she knew there were resources for street kids. As a matter of fact, the world has changed a lot in the past 20 years with the emergence of what we can call the citizen sector, which is really this whole sector of society that's emerging that's not governmental, it's not business, it's all the problem-solving social organizations, all the .orgs that are out there. And the .orgs have always been much bigger than the .coms, both in terms of number, and I would argue in terms of impact in the world too. And yet we have focused so much on the .com side of this major social transformation over the past 20 years. So she saw the .orgs emerging in Bombay in the form of hundreds of child service organizations. And she had the classic entrepreneurial insight of seeing a system that was emerging where there was a real pivot point, where a little bit of leverage in one place on that system could increase the value of the entire system. And that's the classic entrepreneurial insight, is where's that leverage point? And in her case, she said she realized it was the network. If all these organizations could talk to each other, they would be able to work with street kids much more effectively and really create a system. And if they could do it through the telephone system, because Bombay just started having public telephones at that time, this was in the early 90s, that were actually accessible all across the city, the kids could make a phone call and immediately get assistance instead of having to call Giroux at 3 a.m. And do it that way. So she got this idea of creating this network, Childline. This is at the point where she had to do her pitch. And so she went around to 100 with her graduate students. She identified 100 organizations across Bombay that were candidates for being part of this network, which she called Childline. She went to 100 organizations, 100 meetings with them. Will you join this organization? Now, Giroux is a very persuasive person. If you heard her speak now, you would all want to join her organization. She's very charismatic. She has a lot of enthusiasm. She's very clear, and you don't doubt her integrity for 1 second. And yet, 100 organizations, out of 100 organizations, 86 said no. So don't be daunted. And only 14 said, I want to join this network. And I remember interviewing Giroux years later and asking her how she felt that 86 organizations had said no to her. And she said something that has always stuck with me. She said, I was very excited. And I remember thinking, weren't you disappointed? Weren't you disheartened? She said, no, I wasn't. And I remember thinking, I don't quite believe her. But then she explained her reasoning to me, and I thought it was kind of genius. She said, if you really thought about Childline, the single thing that was necessary for this system to work was that all of the organizations had to take ownership of it. They really had to be excited. They really had to want to do this. It couldn't be something that they were lukewarm about. She said, so if you look at 100 organizations and 86 say no, that means that the 14 who said yes must really be excited to do the work. It must mean that they have those qualities. And I thought about it, and she was absolutely right, because those 14 organizations turned out to have tremendous, exactly the kind of motivation that Childline needed. And so she launched with those 14 organizations. And I remember thinking of the kind of mental alchemy that it took to take information that other people would sort of assume was a sign of failure, and in her brain to translate that into a success, and how that created energy for her to move forward, and how important that is for anybody who wants to change their life or do anything new in the world. The ability to create excitement for yourself in the knowledge of what you know is possible and what you know you're capable of doing. So she had to go out and raise some money, and it took a lot of knocking on doors to get $6,000 to get this going. She had to petition the government to get a hotline from the Ministry of Telecommunications. And this took 3 years of persistent efforts, sending faxes to government officials and going to meetings and getting anybody that she knew who was wealthy or politically connected to accompany her to a meeting so that she had a little bit of clout next to her. And through this process, which is the only process by which I think bureaucracies move anywhere in the world, she was able to eventually get a toll-free hotline. First hotline in the history of India, 1098, which was only targeted for children. And then her last question, which was really the creative piece of it, was how do I get paramedics? Who's going to go? And we have a hotline, we have phones, we have shelters that can field the calls. Who's actually going to go and respond to the calls? And she realized that she would never have enough money to hire paramedics. So the system had to work with a whole different human resource. And she realized that the only people available were the street youth themselves. And she would have to train the street youth to pick up the phone and figure out how to respond effectively to a call from another street youth. So she got a school of social work to create a 30-day course to do this. She trained up street youth. She filtered out the ones who aren't responsible and took the ones who were most capable and responsible. And through this process, Childline launched in 1996. And in its first year, it fielded 6,600 calls, and it rescued 858 children from very serious distress. So I'll give you one example. And I would think, in the thinking of the pitches, I've found with a lot of social entrepreneurs that their most effective approach is to really combine sort of a heart story with a head story, and they never leave one piece of that out. So the heart story is this is my heart story about Childline. If I was pitching it to you, some street kids, street youth, were fielding calls in a shelter in Bombay. And they got a phone call from a man in Dadar train station, which is one of the busiest train stations in Bombay, saying that there was a two-year-old girl, looked to be 2 years old, who was naked on the platform. She had been abandoned. There were no adults caring for her. And she looked as if she had a burn on her chest, as if someone had poured hot water on her chest. And then this man had to go. So the kids took this information, they ran to the train station, they looked for the baby, they couldn't find her. They spent several hours there until they found that she had actually been taken by a homeless man, or actually a beggar who lived in the station, who wanted to say that she was his daughter so that he could use her sort of as a prop for begging. So they argued with this man, and he was very belligerent, and he wouldn't give the child to them. So then they went to the transit police officer in the station. He wouldn't also side with the street youth, because the police officers always look at the kids as vagrants. So then they worked up the Childline network, which has all sorts of allies in the police department and in the health system. And through that use of political power, we're able to get this child released into their custody. The child was then brought to a hospital and treated for her burns. She was then placed in a short-term hostel, and an adoption was arranged. And so she was adopted by a middle-class family. So, you know, she's a middle-class Bombay kid. Now she's much older now. I don't know what happened to her. But she could end up, you know, at Pace University. I mean, she's got a middle-class life trajectory now. And if you think about what happened to her life, you know, she was going severely down. And then this man made a phone call, put some energy out into the universe. It was caught by an articulated system that was intelligent and caring. And at that point, her life started going up, you know. And so this point in time was where Childline came in. Make sense to turn a whole city into a team was what really Childline was about. And it worked through this intelligent network. Now, so that was the basic idea. And it was operating in Bombay in 1996. But Giroux was able to get the government to see the value of this idea. She was able to get the private sector to see that this was something that computer companies really needed to get in on in order to systematize all the data that they were getting from the phone calls. And it was something that the marketing companies had to really help with, because they were the ones who understood branding and franchising, which was really what Childline needed to do if it was going to grow. So through this process of pitching, and engaging more and more people, Childline over the past 10 years has gone from Bombay to now it's in 70 cities across India. It's fielded 10 million calls. It's rescued at least 100,000 children from different levels of distress. And it's been adopted by the Indian government as the national child protection system. And it is, so you now have a situation where a call from a street kid in India, in one of these cities, gets fielded, that gets responded to, and then the information in that call gets managed through the software that was created by the Tata Consultancy Group, which is one of the best consulting companies in India for computers. And then that knowledge informs the government's child protection policy at the national level. And all of this was built up in the past 10 years. And I've traveled, you know, across, you know, the United States and lots of other places talking about social entrepreneurship, and I don't think I've come across more than 10 people who've ever heard of Childline. And very few people even who have heard of the Grameen Bank once you get out of sort of development circles. And yet, if you can imagine these two stories, and, you know, the Ashoka Network, which is just the tip of the social entrepreneurship pyramid, has, you know, close to 2,000 fellows in its network. If you can imagine, you know, what it would be like to walk around and have a head full of these stories and think what's possible and how people across, you know, the country would really rethink their views of the world. Because really, this is the reality. You have the emergence of social entrepreneurship. You know, what Bruce was talking about, in 1979, there were 30 schools teaching entrepreneurship, and now there's 2,000. Well, we've seen this trajectory from going from about 5 schools teaching social entrepreneurship to 200 over the past few years. And because of the pace of change today and the pace of communications, and also the great social need for solutions, need that's not being met effectively by the government and is often being ignored by the private sector, you're going to see social entrepreneurship climb a very steep curve over the next decade. I suspect that there will be 2,000 schools, probably in much less than 30 years, teaching social entrepreneurship. And so I think, you know, what we have here is, you know, the emergence of a new career path, a new trajectory that is very exciting. And it's exciting because it allows people to align what they do every day with what they really care about, with what the world most needs. And this is something that will really free up a lot of positive energy. I think one of the things that I try to do is to really to make these changes visible. Because right now, if you want to get into social entrepreneurship, you really have to be kind of a hunter-gatherer, a good investigator. You have to go out and hunt out those opportunities for yourself. It's not like they're coming to the campus and recruiting. Except for Teach for America, which is a very good recruiter, there's very few organizations that really put themselves in your face the way the big businesses do. So you have to go and seek these opportunities for yourself. But they're out there. College Summit, one of the organizations that I write about in How to Change the World, when I started writing about them, which wasn't a long time ago, it was probably 7 years ago, had 9 employees, and today it has 100 employees. And in fact, it's the new chief executive officer of College Summit used to be the one of the vice presidents of NASDAQ, and was formerly the chief executive officer of Fresh Direct Foods, which is the internet delivery service for foods. So he has said, I feel like being the CEO of an organization that's providing college access to kids rather than being the CEO of this company. So that's a really big opportunity. And I just want to end with a note of encouragement to the pitchers, because this is your night. When Muhammad Yunus first pitched the Grameen Bank to the bankers, they thought he was crazy, and they basically told him that the idea just didn't make sense and could never possibly fly. Poor people would never pay back the loan. When Bill Drayton first pitched the idea to foundations of an organization that would go around the world supporting social entrepreneurs in this venture kind of model, he literally could not get a grant from major foundations for 5 years. And Bill Drayton, if any of you have met him, is a very persuasive person. He's not somebody who can't get you to think he knows what he's doing. And the same thing with J.B. Schramm, who started College Summit. He needed to raise $13,000, and he got no's from 25 people before he got his first grant. And he got it over a conversation at a Mexican restaurant with one individual. And that person didn't even believe so much in his idea as that person believed in him. Because what she said to him was, I don't think what you're promising you're going to do, you can actually do, but I know that something good will come out of this because I know I can see who you are. And that was, so I think the final thing for that you can convince, and what a pitch really should ultimately be about the idea, and it should really be about you. And if there's one thing to get across in a very short period of time, it's the idea that you have an unbending will to realize your idea and make it work, and at the same time, limitless flexibility in the way you're going to try to do it. So thank you very much.